Hi, this is Anthony Capizzoli with the Channel IQ Add to Cart podcast series, which is part of the Channel IQU and our Compass projects. So what I'd like to do today is invite Mr. Eugene Zelick back to the show. Thank you so much for being a part of it. And we're going to be talking about Costco versus Johnson & Johnson and other class action lawsuits, understand the impact that might have for all of us who are monitoring MAP and pricing, and get a better understanding of what this might mean to you as manufacturers and, on the other side of that, retailers as well. So, Gene, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. The good news is for all of us interested in this area, because at what is at issue is, among other things, the resale price policies that each of the four major contact lens manufacturers are using. The good news is that these lawsuits really don't change anything. So while there undoubtedly will be some hyperbole over this and concerns about it, at least at this point, no new issues. In fact, probably the worst thing about them is that they cast a spotlight on this area, where I believe that it's better if things are kept more quietly, and not because they were illegal, but because who wants people looking at this very carefully? So maybe that's the biggest issue. But let's talk about these cases just a little bit. As you mentioned, Anthony, the very first one was indeed filed by Costco against Johnson & Johnson, and it was filed early this month, that is, early in March. And what it alleges is that the resale price policy used by Johnson & Johnson on disposable contact lenses was the product of a conspiracy. That is, all of the contact lens manufacturers got together in a smoke-filled room and or otherwise, and they agreed to all put in resale price policies, largely to placate, by the way, so-called ECPs, or eye care professionals. Now, let's just pause there for a second. The reason this supposedly took place is because the eye care professionals, those are the ophthalmologists and optometrists, who examine eyes and write prescriptions for contact lenses, they not only prescribe the strength of the lens, but they also prescribe the brand. And many of them also dispense the contact lenses themselves. And because of some changes in the law a few years ago, these eye care professionals are required to provide all their customers with written prescriptions that they can take any place. So in other words, they're not locked into their eye care professional for buying the lenses. So there are many out there, many retailers, that just sell the lenses, and Costco is one of them. They may have had an affiliated, or I should say an independent, ophthalmologist or optometrist on the premises, but what they were really about doing was selling replacement lenses, usually at a substantial discount. When the manufacturers put in these policies beginning in about 2013, and they did so sequentially, they didn't do it all at once, but they did it sequentially, the lawsuit claims that 97% of the disposable contact lens market is now subject to these policies, and as a result, there is no little or no price differences. And that, again, that they were done to try to keep happy the eye care professionals, and level the playing field in that regard. Well, Costco went after Johnson & Johnson and only Johnson & Johnson because it wasn't buying lenses from the other people, and claims that Johnson & Johnson had essentially agreed with it in terms of what the resale price should be. Now, what's ironic about that is that less than a week later, or about a week later, the fourth of four class actions were filed. The third of the fourth, one week later, were filed. And it targets not only the contact lens manufacturers, all of them, not just Johnson & Johnson, but also targets major retailers, including Costco, Walmart, Meijer, and two web retailers, 1-800-CONTACTS and Lens Discounters. So by Costco saying that the not only was the this resale price policy used by Costco, used by Johnson & Johnson, by saying that not only it was the product of this horizontal conspiracy, but moreover, saying in its pleadings that it essentially agreed to go along with it, I think that set the stage for the later lawsuit. So again, to cut through everything, what's going on here is, so Costco went after Johnson & Johnson, and then later there were four consumer class actions filed against all the contact lens manufacturers, some retailers in some cases, a major distributor called ABB, and some online sellers, claiming that they were all part of this conspiracy to set these resale prices. Now, the reason for no real concern here, at least in terms of all the people that we work with, and at this point we've probably done 100 resale price policies or MAP programs. The difference, to make that point, resale price covers the advertised price as well as the actual selling price, where a MAP program covers only the advertised price, and the selling price is wide open. In these contact lens cases, all the manufacturers have resale price policies. But to draw the distinction here as to why these cases are not of great concern, at least not at this point, is because the companies we work with, and I suspect most of the companies, if not all of the ones that Channel IQ works with, have done these as policies as opposed to agreements. That is, under an old case, it's almost 100 years old now, called Colgate, the Supreme Court in the United States said it's perfectly okay for manufacturers to set minimum resale prices, and to do so unilaterally, that is, by a policy. In fact, the court went beyond that to say it's perfectly okay to set the terms and conditions under which a manufacturer will do business, including a minimum resale price, provided that it's done by policy. In that case, even though it's very old at this point, subsequent Supreme Court cases have endorsed it, in fact, as late as 2007. So the bottom line is, if you do this by unilateral policy, the antitrust laws in the United States simply don't apply. Why? Because the primary law in the area is the Sherman Act, which requires a contract combination or conspiracy in order to have jurisdiction. And as a requirement. So what that means is, if you do it unilaterally, which is just you announce the policy, there's no negotiation, it's not in an agreement, you're simply outside the antitrust laws. An exception to that is if all the manufacturers in an industry get together in a smoke-filled room or otherwise, and they agree to put these in place. It's not the policy that's illegal, in a sense. It's really the fact that they all got together to agree to put it in a place. And then secondly, which is always a danger, is that there are situations where what is purports to be a policy, because there are negotiations that take place with retailers, and sometimes it really does find its way into agreements, then that policy is converted into an agreement. So what's at issue in the cases is a horizontal price-fixing agreement among manufacturers, and in some cases a vertical price-fixing agreement between a manufacturer and a reseller. And that's why I say that for all the companies that are very careful about how they do this, there's nothing to worry about, because there is no conspiracy, there is no manufacturers getting together to do this. The companies arrive at this position themselves, or they may see their competitors do this and they may decide they need to do it too, but there's no communication over the issue or whatever. Similarly, they're very careful about the way they implement the policies to avoid any kind of agreement with resellers. And if the steps are taken in these cases, even if they're proven that the manufacturers did what they're alleged to have done, again, it really doesn't change things.
What does what is the goal for Costco in the case of Costco versus Johnson & Johnson? If you were to just net that out, what is Costco hoping to accomplish here?
Well, it's interesting you should raise that, because it's so unusual to have resellers go after manufacturers. The exception to that is sometimes when there are termination issues, particularly in the business-to-business area, where a manufacturer will stop doing business with a distributor or with a dealer or something like that. we'll see some litigation result in that. But this is really unusual, particularly because Costco presumably wants to continue a relationship with Johnson & Johnson. And so that's a very good question. And in fact, specifically what they're asking for in the complaint is that the court declare that the there was an agreement on resale prices, and the agreement was illegal, and strike it down. I think what they're after is not so much dollar damages or anything like that. I think they simply want to get rid of this pricing system that was adopted by the contact lens manufacturers. And my guess is that's what they're doing, but of course, in my mind anyway, one of the reasons that I don't think resellers typically go after manufacturers, at least not in the consumer side of things, is because perhaps the resellers have some dirty linen, and they simply don't want it to come out. And in a nasty knockdown, drag-em-out battle, those things are likely to come out in court. So here, Costco did that, and lo and behold, a week later, they get sued themselves.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, maybe it was inevitable they would have gotten sued. And given the timing of these cases, it tells me this has been brewing for a while. And in fact, because they were all filed within a week, some of the other things by way of background that are important, the contact lens manufacturers were sued in 96 for setting prices, not by policy, but by truly meeting in a smoke-filled room. And in 2001, those cases were settled out, and they agreed they wouldn't do anything to set prices or affect prices or whatever. And that burned off, that restriction burned off. So the industry has a history of doing this in the past, which turns out to be an important fact that I'll come back to later. So you had that. There were hearings that were held by a Senate subcommittee in July of last year that looked at the contact lens manufacturers, because again, the whole industry is doing this. And so that always stirs the pot and undoubtedly got some people really interested in this. And then, actually it goes back a few years, as I mentioned, there was a law passed probably after the original 96 case was filed. There was a law passed in Congress that requires eye care professionals to give prescriptions or make prescriptions available to everybody so that they could go to whoever they wanted to get the prescriptions filled. But I think, Anthony, one of the things that comes out of this litigation, and I stress that it's very early in it. I mean, these cases aren't even a month old. We've not heard anything from the manufacturers, any kind of defenses. My guess is there'll be a general denial, and there may well be, these things may be litigated over a period of years. They may get settled out. I mean, who knows what. But we just haven't heard anything from the other side, so it's preliminary. But if any of these allegations are true, one of the things that comes out is that the manufacturers were not so smart about how, at least some of them were not so smart, about how they implemented their programs. And that's the lesson, I think, for Channel IQ clients and others. And again, assuming the allegations are correct, it was reported that or alleged that Alcon, which is one of the defendants, had, at least in one case, and you know, it implies that there were many others, and that remains to be seen, but they required a reseller to sign a document that not only had they received the policy, but they agreed to follow it. That converts it into an agreement, and that's really sloppy and nasty. The allegations involving Johnson & Johnson is that it sat down with Costco, so it introduced its policy. Costco didn't like it, sat down with Costco and negotiated various changes to it, which, according to the complaint, it changed to, I think there's now a generation four, and the policy is about a year old, but it's now its fourth generation, each time trying to accommodate Costco and some others. Now, having been there many times myself, there are ways to do this, and there are ways to do this, because you certainly want to try to accommodate some of your biggest and best customers. But it looks like the way Johnson & Johnson did it was rather ham-handed. And it really makes it look like, because of the negotiations and the results that came out of it, it really wasn't a policy, it was an agreement. Now, again, this assumes that the everything in the complaint is true, and it remains to be seen whether it is. But those are sort of the lessons to take out of it is, you know, be very careful about how you implement these things, because it's critical, particularly in the resale price side, to maintain it as a unilateral policy to avoid any kind of agreement.
But to back up a little farther,
remember what's at issue in this case is first alleging a horizontal conspiracy that is among competitive manufacturers to all adopt these policies and set resale prices. And then there's also alleged to be a vertical agreement involving manufacturers and resellers like Costco, where the resellers agreed to go along with it. The law says that just because somebody follows a policy is not an agreement, and that's hardly illegal. But if there are more things going on, such as this negotiation that I mentioned, policies are never negotiated. They are what they are. And that tends to indicate that there's an agreement, again, assuming that the allegations are accurate. Anyway, I interrupted you, Anthony. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. The question that I'd like to raise for many of our clients on the manufacturing side is they very often invite retailers to participate or sign on as authorized retailers. That doesn't mean that they sign anything. That just means that they become part of them. Very often they'll visit a website, they'll sign on, they'll identify the URLs they're going to be using for online sales. But that happens outside of kind of the reach of the MAP program. The MAP policy is the MAP policy. What they're asking for is to invite the retailers to participate in the sunshine of positive partnership, which just means things like you'd be better supported with marketing collateral, with the support that you might need from the manufacturer. So many of our clients had asked, will this have an impact on that process? So I just wanted to ask you, as legal counsel, what your thoughts are about that process.
It shouldn't affect it at all. And in fact, what we often do with clients that come to us either to do a first-generation resale price or MAP policy or a second- or third-generation one. Their existing policy may not be working. In all likelihood, it was something we were not involved with originally, and they ask us to help them make it better. But as part of that process, we often say, well, you know, it's great to have a policy, and as part of it, you need to talk about what are the penalties for people who violated it. And what happens in a frequent penalty is being cut off in whole or part for the manufacturer's products for repetitive violations. Well, the only way you can make that stick is if you control distribution. For those manufacturers that sell to anybody with a pulse, it's no wonder that products wind up on eBay and they wind up in the Amazon marketplaces or whatever. So getting a handle on distribution is important, and we often recommend, in fact, we often do, as part of putting in a policy or revamping an existing one, putting in agreements with resellers. We could call them retailer agreements or dealer agreements or whatever. Sometimes they're only at the retail level. Sometimes when there are price erosion problems or other issues, we put them in both at the wholesale level, if there is a wholesale level. A very common practice, of course, among many companies is they sell to the bigger retailers directly, and they sell to the smaller ones indirectly through wholesalers. So we put agreements in place that actually facilitate operation of the policies. But to your point, Anthony, none of them talk about price. There's not a word in there about price.
Right.
But we may require, for example, in the wholesaler agreement or the distributor agreement, that they will honor our do not sell list. So when we cut somebody off, they can't sell them. That's entirely separate. Well, it supports the policy. It's actually governed by a different set of laws, and that's it's not an issue. It's entirely separate. Similarly, with a retailer, we may ban them from selling to other retailers. Why? Because if we cut off a bad retailer, we don't want them getting supplied by anybody else. But those are handled separately. And sure, while they're designed as part of a total program, they're, as I mentioned, governed by a separate set of standards. Same laws, different standards. And we're very comfortable in using those. So needless to say, for those people that put in distribution agreements, so they go the authorization route that you were talking about, Anthony, and they don't have a policy in place, well, then that's even clearer that tends not to be an issue. But even if they do have a policy in place, as long as you're careful about the way you do it and you do things to support your program, but there's nothing, absolutely nothing in the agreement that says you agree to follow our resale price or MAP program or whatever, that it should not be an issue.
Good deal. That's I'm sure that the manufacturers are happy to hear that. And so, overarching with the lawsuits raised, both for Costco versus Johnson & Johnson, and the other lawsuits raised, as you say, what's the takeaway or the impact to other manufacturers in terms of this? And should they just wait and see kind of what goes on? Because I think the hurry up and wait is probably a good strategy. Because I believe in do something, do nothing, and if do nothing works, then let's do nothing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that is the what makes the most sense. Among other things, because the reason for putting in MAP and resale price policies, or the reasons for them, have not gone away. You still have the price erosion issues, and that hasn't changed at all. And obviously, we're all familiar with many very successful programs that work to counter that kind of problem. So I think stand still and wait makes sense. I think that something else would be, it might be worthwhile to review procedures and make sure that things are being done appropriately and that nothing snuck in like over a period of time. And again, we still see this all the time where manufacturers will have a written agreement and in it it'll say, you agree to follow our resale price or MAP policy. That's a big no-no because it converts it into an agreement. Not so bad on the MAP side, because then it governed under something called the rule of reason, which is a manufacturer favorable standard. But fatal on the resale price side, because about five states have taken the point of view that these kinds of things are illegal on their face. There is one other thing that's come up, and I mentioned that the I don't like cases like these because they shine a light in this particular area. The same thing happened in 2007 when the Supreme Court changed its standards in this area where agreements are present. At the federal law, it's much more liberal than it is at the state level, and that was very controversial. Anyway, there's a big light that was shined on things for a while, and then it went away. There are a number of states that are talking about putting in laws that would ban any kind of resale price fixing agreements involving contact lens manufacturers. So this may be just kind of piling on, but I certainly hope that doesn't spread. That having been said, again, to my knowledge, these proposals only attack agreements. They don't attack policies. I should make one more point because I alluded to it earlier. In these kinds of cases, in fact, in all of these, and I've read all the complaints, what the plaintiffs hope for is a smoking pistol, and some really good evidence that the manufacturers met in a smoke-filled room, that they all agreed, and so on. Well, it's so rare that that kind of evidence exists that the law says, well, if there isn't an agreement, one can be inferred, or if there isn't evidence of an agreement, one can be inferred. And that's exactly what these cases talk about. So it makes it harder for the plaintiffs. It's better if they find a smoking pistol, and maybe through discovery and the process of reviewing records and deposing people and so on, some smoking pistols will come out. But what absent that, and these complaints all allege, they try to cover all their bases, to infer the presence of an agreement or conspiracy, two things are required. The first thing is conscious parallelism. And conscious parallelism is not illegal in and of itself. In fact, it's the essence of competition. Conscious parallelism is the one company deciding to follow the lead of another. And if you think about a competition that happens every day, think of the stereotypical three gas stations on their respective corners around an intersection. One guy goes up by 2 cents a gallon. The guy across the street goes up by 2 cents. The third guy goes up. That's perfectly lawful. Where it isn't lawful is if they agree over coffee or whatever, hey, I'll go up if you go up, okay? But absent that, just the fact that they mirror what the other one does, nothing wrong with that. But that is the first requirement, is conscious parallelism. The second requirement is something called a plus factor, and that is some circumstantial evidence that makes it look like an agreement is in place. And there are a bunch of things that the courts will look to. The first one is what I mentioned before, and that is a history of price fixing in the industry. And sadly, this industry has some history. Another thing to look at is doing things that are counter to self-interest, but consistent with there being a conspiracy. And that's alleged too, saying that, you know, why wouldn't these manufacturers allow discounting if it increases their market share? And then they've alleged a number of other things to try to show that. So they do not have an easy task unless they find a smoking pistol. As I said, this really doesn't change things. But to go back to the point, I would say this highlights making sure that what you've done correctly in terms of implementing and in terms of the design of the program. If not, tweak it as quickly as possible. Take a look and see if it's originally designed, things have kind of deviated one way or another, and we need to kind of get the horse back in the barn. That's one thing. Be very careful of these things like sitting down and negotiating with big customers and then changing your programs accordingly. Just watch what you're doing to keep it careful. I think the other thing as I reflect on this is there be careful if you're in an industry where a lot of people are doing this. Now, it doesn't mean it's illegal. It doesn't mean that there's a conspiracy, but it does shine a light in terms of what's going on. That just means I think you've got to be a little bit more careful because there may be some very good reasons why everybody has unilaterally decided to put in a policy. And indeed, I suspect that's what the contact lens manufacturers are going to say. They're going to come back and say, look, we didn't put these policies all at once. They were sequenced. Right. We did it, then the guy down the street did it, the differences are months, not days. We were just, it's conscious parallels, and there is no evidence that we agreed, and this kind of thing. So again, it may not be, it's not an easy case to win, right? I don't think there are easy cases to win, but there's certainly a lot of piling on, and you always get in this, and this strikes me as an element of it. There are some law firms that specialize in class action litigation, and what they're looking for, quite frankly, is not necessarily a stunning victory. What they're looking for is a settlement, and the bigger the dollars, the better. Not all firms are like this, but it's where you sometimes, we've all read about these, where a class action will be brought and settled out, and the people who supposedly suffered due to the price fixing or whatever receive $1.98, while the lawyers walk away with millions of dollars. So there's an element of that going on. Who knows? But again, this does not change things. It just means, if nothing else, be careful how you do it. Not whether to do it or not. If it's still important to do it, you do it. But all the more reasons to do it correctly.
That's great. Gene, thank you very, very much for being a part of the show today. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to share your website and email address at Freeborn and Peters. Gene Zelig, of course, is a partner. Mr. Zelig's email address is ezelek@freeborn.com. You can also learn more about Gene and Freeborn and Peters at freeborn.com, which is their website. Gene, I'm sure we'll have you back on the show very often to talk about great stuff like we did today. It is always a pleasure, sir.
Well, my pleasure, and stay the course. This is the interesting and necessary stuff, and I don't think that this really changes the things very much other than be careful.
Wonderful. Thank you, sir. Have a wonderful day, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.